welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are, this is Eric.
By the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex. Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is true.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen. And not a one of you is prepared for it.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road. And, you know, anyway. Welcome. This is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
This is Drew.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 2007 classic Into the Wild, directed by Sean Penn.
Classic?
Did you know that Sean Penn, this wasn't his first feature that he directed?
No, what else did he direct?
He directed two Jack Nicholson movies, The Crossing Guard and The Pledge, and then the Indian Runner with David Morse, Viggo Mortensen, Charles Bronson, Patricia Arquette, and Dennis Hopper.
That's an interesting combination.
Yeah.
I haven't seen either of those two movies.
Three movies.
Sorry.
Yeah.
See? I wasn't even paying attention.
I've seen The Crossing Guard and The Pledge.
And? Are they lesser Nicholson's?
Nicholson was very good, but the movies were kind of snoozers.
Ah. Well, not this movie. This movie is action-packed. Based on a book written by John Krakauer.
Yay.
Which is just an expansion of a magazine article he wrote for Outside Magazine in 1993. So, Brother Jay, was this on your list?
Well, it wasn't on my list. It was on something that I wanted. It kept popping up in my queue to watch, and I've never seen it. And so I thought, I have plenty of opinions about this, but I've never seen the movie. So I'd like to watch the movie so I can either get a better opinion if my opinion and biases are accurate or not, they were borne out.
Well, I think I alluded that I have three opinions, three trains of thought about this movie.
Appropriate.
I have an opinion of the movie, and I have an opinion of the guy, Christopher McCandless, and I have an opinion of the legend of Alexander Supertramp.
Okay. All right. Well, that seems fair.
It's all a piece, though, so.
Oh, schizophrenia.
Yeah. So, and Drew, you had seen this movie before?
I had.
Yeah, me too. Let's see, I guess.
Oh, well, so I was the only one who hadn't seen it.
Yeah, so as the first-time viewer, what did you think, Jason?
Okay, well, so I will take it as your three parts. As this movie is a Krakauer vehicle expansion, it was a fine movie. It was entertaining. It was a little disorienting at times because of course, the flashbacks and flash forwards. As testament to Alexander Supertramp, Chris McCandless, he is the adult face of mental illness. So, also had a death wish, apparently.
That's the most charitable reading of McCandless.
Yeah, well, he's dead, so I mean he got punished for his misdeeds or missteps, so I thought it was a fine movie. It was a pretty movie. It was very gorgeous, especially because it reminds me of places that I have been growing up, whether or not much of it was shot on location or not. It was surprising. So it was familiar, but also the attitude was familiar because I grew up coming into contact with people who would come from outside, especially where I worked, when I would have to stay in the store and help out, and people would come in for sporting goods stuff and say, well, I'm going to go do this for a couple of weeks, and I just want a pack for this. I'm like, no, 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 no. I guess I come at it from a couple different angles too.
Brother Drew, what's your thought on the movie? We'll start with the movie.
I had a much more positive memory of the movie. I hated this movie. It was fun to see parts of Alaska, and it was fun to sort of watch it as a travelogue. But I didn't like the style of the movie. The story of McCandless, that's probably a separate issue for me. But just the way the movie was put together, I really, really hated it.
The back and forth in time, or?
The back and forth, the wannabe auteur bullshit, you know, all the artsy angles and lighting effects and, you know, the sort of disjointed, slow motion video over, sort of unconnected narration. I didn't find any of that to be effective. This really seemed like a movie made by a wannabe. So I'm actually surprised to hear that he had 3 movies under his belt before he made this. You know, just like the one I rolled my eyes the hardest at was sort of the end narration by the sister, the voiceover that showed an extremely wasted, not like drug wasted, but like wasted talent of William Hurt sort of crying in the street. It's like, get the fuck out of here. Come on. You can do better than this. I expect better than this from everybody involved.
I thought everybody gave it their all, though. I mean, I thought all the acting was pretty good.
Yeah, that's fine. I don't fault the actors. I don't fault the actors for anything that went wrong in this movie.
Did anybody else think it was about an hour too long?
I thought it was getting... I thought there were some definitely some parts that could have stood a better edit.
My most positive memory from this movie was Hal Holbrook. I thought he was fantastic.
Yeah,
he was. So I kept waiting and waiting and waiting for him to show up. I did not remember that it was not until the very end. So I liked Hal Holbrook quite a bit.
That was the hardest thing to watch for me.
Yeah, that was pretty tough. I liked Rainey. Rainey a lot. And he had such a great voice.
Oh, I thought it was Jeff Bridges at first.
Yeah, he definitely has the Jeff Bridges voice.
And do you know the Rainey story?
No.
Yeah, you know, Rainey's not an actor. Rainey actually is, according to the Arizona Daily Sun, he has probably rafted the Grand Canyon more than any other boatsman. He does work for the government, but he also does technical advice. He gives technical advice to movies. So he was like the rafting and aquatic technical advisor on this movie.
Well, he had feet like flippers.
Well, it was Emil Hirsch that actually told Sean Penn that, hey, this is the guy we want to play Rainey.
Oh, nice.
He was good. That's a good role for, I guess, a non-actor person, because the character of Rainey, I don't know if it was already written this way or if they made it this way to suit his talents, but so Rainey is sort of the hippie, laconic, monotone kind of guy, and he did a good job.
Yeah. He reminded me of the band leader from the Muppets.
Dr. Teeth?
Yeah.
Because
he had the mannerisms, and he was just mellow. He was totally... So I was like, he was just understated.
Yeah, no, it was great. I thought he was the biggest surprise of this movie. But I liked everybody else. I mean, I really did. I mean,
well, I didn't recognize Zach Galifianakis.
I didn't, but when I found it was Zach Galifianakis, it did not surprise me.
No, same here. And Vince Vaughn, I thought, holy crap. He was a surprise.
Yeah.
So this movie was full of surprises.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to just admit this up front. I got tired of the Eddie Vedder soundtrack.
Oh, my God.
Halfway into the first song.
I didn't even get that far. The intro? What the hell is with all the Pearl Jam Eddie Vedder music? I'm not going to last.
It wasn't Pearl Jam. It was original.
No. I know. Yeah. But I was grasping at straws and hoping beyond hope.
And that's sort of the wannabe auteur bullshit, I think.
I think so.
Let's just have a haunting Eddie Vedder wailing right here to set the mood.
Well, and yeah. You know, like Sean Penn told Eddie Vedder, hey, I want you to do the soundtrack to my next movie. And he's like, yes, without even knowing what the movie was. So,
of course.
Yeah. So it was a thing.
Well, I mean, I give Eddie Vedder credit. He definitely committed. I mean, he gave it his all. So
yeah, and it wasn't bad. It just wasn't for me, and it kind of got repetitive.
Yeah, I don't think it was bad. It took away from the movie. It took me out of the movie because it drove too much away from the movie because it didn't need to be that way.
And this is, again, this is kind of going to dip into my other trains of thought, but this is a fantasy of what happened to this real guy.
Yeah, because nobody knows what happened, because he died.
Well, and there was a small little diary, and there's his parents and his sister. And by all accounts, Krakauer did a fine job. I mean, the article itself, you know, it's a long form piece in Outside Magazine, but to make it into a book, and I think I didn't read it, but I think I listened to like the abridged audiobook on cassette, and so you know, I didn't get the full breadth of it, except that you know, to tell this guy's story in a novel length book, it's really kind of. His story is interspersed in between stories of lots of other people who go out and get lost in the woods. And then, of course, Krakauer, you know, he's sort of telling his own story as well. So, you know, the
story is as much about all of the people around as much as it's about him.
Well, it's a very romantic view of this Christopher McCandless guy who I didn't like any part of in this movie.
I didn't either.
He's not likable. I feel bad for him.
No, I think the movie is trying to convince you that he's likable.
Yeah, I think so. Oh. I think he's supposed to be like a spiritual sort of figure.
Now, maybe it's the Alaskan in me, but I just kept thinking, stupid, 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 stupid. I'm sorry that you're stupid, but... You know.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not an outdoorsman, but yeah, I mean, Alaska is a brutal place. So if you're going to go out in the woods, you kind of get what you get if you are unprepared.
Well, that's the thing. And like, again, and I've read some articles about the movie and I'm not the only one, but there's lots of people that are like, no, he was suicidal. He had a death wish. He wanted to go out and lose himself. And that's what happened.
Well, I don't know about suicidal, but he certainly was not prepared.
Again, we are looking at the face of mental illness.
Yeah, but it's not presented as mental illness. It's presented the idealism of youth.
Of course, because nobody wants to talk about mental illness. They want to gloss over it, say it's artist.
Well, yeah, so there's a couple options, right? Yeah, one, he was mentally ill and that illness sort of informed a lot of bad decisions he made. Or he was an asshole. I don't think this movie really touches on any mental illness. I think it paints him as somebody who must have been extremely magnetic and charismatic because everybody he came in contact with seemed to love him. But what I think I had a slightly different take on it the first time I watched it many years ago. But I'm at a phase in my life now where I just see the utter destruction that he left behind him for all the people that cared about him. I mean, I that seems to be a really narcissistic way to go about your life. 'Cause it's one thing if you're punishing your abusive parents by sort of disappearing. But by all accounts, he had a good relationship with his sister, who he also abandoned and left wondering. And
left with the abusive parents.
Yes.
See, that's why I think it's more mental illness than it is asshole. Because there's people that he came in contact with that had very positive interactions that wanted to keep in touch with him, that he, you know, didn't necessarily break ties with as much as he was temporarily removed because of his cause, his goal.
Yeah, well, people tend to love, like psychopaths and sociopaths when they first meet them. Until they realize all the damage that will be caused in their lives for having them around.
Yeah, but you just made my point for me. Those people have mental defects.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it's as much pathological as, I mean, I can buy it. It just being him being young and extremely naive and having the ability, because, you know, he came from a relatively rich family, to be able to just kind of make a statement and going on like a spiritual journey. And he's the right age for that sort of thing. He's also the right age for schizophrenia and all sorts of stuff too.
Exactly.
But, yeah. But, I mean, the movie portrays him as like a figure that floats through people's lives and just leaves joy in his wake. Except of course for his sister and his parents.
Well, but he doesn't. I mean, I see what you're saying, but, he is definitely selfish.
Extremely. 100%. Yeah. Yeah. But again, nice. I think this is a romantic view. This movie is portraying this extremely romantic view. Like he floats around and never really forms any permanent attachments to anybody.
Yeah. I think that, it would have been a harder sell to make this a movie about mental illness.
The fact that he dies at the end, and it's a true story. So spoiler, everybody, he died.
He'd been dead long time.
Yeah, the fact that he died of starvation in the woods, it's portrayed as like a misadventure. Like he just like used up, like he'd been sort of blessed with the luck of fools through all the rest of the journey you see him taking. And except for getting beat up by the railroad bulls, I guess they call them, the security, railroad police or whatever. Like he never had a bad time. Although in LA, you kind of get the feeling that he doesn't like people very much didn't want to be involved in the like for real, like well, crazy land. Skid Row.
He was also white. So that helped him.
Well, I mean, he was a privileged person. He had every privilege.
That's what I'm saying. He had lots of privilege.
The privilege of youth, the privilege of white, the privilege of wealth.
Yeah. It was educated.
Yeah.
He had an he had all kinds of advantages. And a certain arrogant naivete.
To me, he reminds me of the self-important, naive college student.
Mm-hmm.
This has
absolutely
like really grandiose visions, but no knowledge, no actual like experience.
No street smarts.
Well, and no experience to beat the foolishness out of you.
Yeah. And I think his previous successes, at least portrayed by the movie, he had lots of success in things he tried across the country. And mostly probably dumb luck. But that instilled him with this, you know, cloak of invincibility that he just wielded as more protection against the elements and his crazy, I suspect.
Okay, so did anybody else think that maybe this is somebody that our parents would have made friends with?
I didn't go there.
But... I mean, he's a lovable stray.
Yes.
Well, he doesn't own any firearms.
100%.
I mean, I'm not saying that's bad for anybody. I'm just saying, oh yeah, no, this guy would have eaten at the cabin at some point.
Are you saying dad's rainy?
Well, I mean,
I think mom's rainy.
Yeah. Anyway, so shall we dive into the plot of the movie and then we can talk about all the other outlying things?
I mean, we've gotten a half an hour into it and haven't really talked about the plot. We're already better off than last week.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. So to start off with, there's this asshole who decides he doesn't like money.
Hold on. Let's give peace a chance there, brother. In April 1992, Christopher McCandless, played by Emil Hirsch, who, by the way, he has his own problems, but he was in, I know him from a movie called The Autopsy of Jane Doe, which is a little horror movie with he and Brian Cox. It was great.
Oh, Brian Cox.
Very atmospheric. Yeah. It's worth seeing if you haven't.
I've seen it.
Also, after the Eddie Vedder, I'm like, oh, crap, another Eddie Vedder song. Then I got punished for that thought with Call Up the Country, and we're gonna go.
Oh, I fucking hate that song.
The Lovers, the Dreamers, and me. La, na, na, ni, na, na. Anyway. Okay, so he arrives in a remote area of the Denali National Park and Preserve in Alaska, and sets up a campsite in an abandoned bus. At first, McCandless is content with the isolation, the beauty of nature, the thrill of living off the land. He hunts wild animals with a .22 caliber rifle, reads books, and keeps a diary as he prepares himself for a new life in the wild.
Fancies himself a modern-day philosopher.
Yes. Years earlier, in May 1990, McCandless graduated with high honors from Emory University. Shortly afterward, McCandless rejects his conventional life by destroying all of his credit cards and identification documents. He donates nearly his entire savings of $24,000 to Oxfam and sets out on a cross-country drive in his well-used yet reliable Datsun to experience life in the wilderness. Wonder what his degree was at Emory.
He had a bachelor's in... I just read this, too. I looked it up in Wikipedia. One moment.
Like literature or philosophy or...
No, it was some kind of history. Huh.
Of course.
Liberal arts, the worst.
So if he was graduating college today, he'd be the dude who just listened to some sort of deep dive podcast and then would not shut up about telling you about it, right?
So he, yeah. He had a bachelor's degree in double majors of history and anthropology.
Oh, well, there you go. So, however, McCandless does not tell his parents, Walt, played by Leto Atreides, William Hurt, and Billy McCandless, played by Marcia Gay Harden.
By the way, those degrees were specifically chosen to punish his father.
I'm sure. We know Marcia Gay Harden, his mother, from Miller's Crossing. Or his sister, Karen. His sister, Karine. Played by Jenna Malone from Contact. He does not keep them involved in what he's doing or where he's going, and he doesn't keep in touch with them after his departure, and they become increasingly anxious and desperate. And both Sean Penn and John Krakauer talk to the family extensively. So a lot of this, and then Karine wrote her own book called The Wild Truth. So I think this is where like the myth-making starts, if that makes sense.
In what way?
If most of your information is coming from the grieving family,
they're going to romanticize him.
Exactly, yeah.
You don't speak ill of the dad.
Karine told Krakauer about the abuse of the father particularly, but swore him to secrecy, at least where his book was concerned, and he agreed with that. He kept her secret. But in her book, she got to tell the secret. Actually, that sounds more critical than I meant it to be. It's just, you know, it's processing, I'm sure. It's, you know, I've never dealt with this sort of
thing. But it ended up in the screenplay.
Yeah. Yeah, elements of there, absolutely.
Okay.
So we get this constant narration, which, because he spends a lot of time by himself or thinking, you need something to put the scenes together, unless you edit it so it's a lot more tight.
Yeah, this is no Castaway.
Yeah, you can get a lot of cool lighting art scenes with clever camera angles if you have narration over it. So at Lake Mead, his automobile is caught in a flash flood, forcing him to abandon it and begin hitchhiking. He burns what remains of his dwindling cash supply and assumes a new name, Alexander Supertramp. In Northern California, he encounters a hippie couple named Jan Burris, Catherine Keener, from Being John Malkovich, Capote, Out of Sight, and Sicario 2, Day of the Soldado. And Rainey, played by Brian Dierker. Again, love Rainey. I mean, Catherine Keener is great too, but... So Rainey tells McCandless about his failing marriage, or relationship with Jan, and McCandless works his magic to try to rekindle that. Let's see, I've got a quote here from the Jeff Bridges-sounding mother trucker, Dierker. The quote is, I trained Emil to get ready for the Whitewater segments. I coached him on that end of it. And when I took on the acting role, he kind of put me under his actor's wing. It was very generous and helpful. And I'd say working across from a seasoned professional like Catherine Keener doesn't hurt either.
Well, having her as your love interest, I mean...
Oh, yeah.
You could do much worse than that.
By September, McCandless...
Do you think they talked him into taking the role by telling him that they'd shoehorn in a sex scene?
I don't know. By September, McCandless stops in Carthage, South Dakota, to work for a contract harvesting company owned by Wayne Westerberg, Vince Vaughn. That's where we meet Kevin, Zach Galifianakis, who imparts his special brand of hillbilly wisdom.
If you got the maggots and the flies, it's too late, Mr. Hoover.
So, Wayne, though, gets arrested. Now, what does Wayne get arrested for? I mean, I know what it says in the plot, but in the movie...
Something about illegal black box cable boxes or satellite boxes.
Yeah, illegal satellite boxes.
Was that mentioned at all?
In the movie, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. I guess...
It wasn't super clear, but they alluded to it because he was... They were cracked satellite boxes.
Yeah, he either gave one or showed one to McCandless. McCandless said, oh, that's one of those illegal satellite boxes. And he said, yeah. And then later he was arrested.
In a very flamboyant way. It was very Dukes of Hazzard style.
Yeah, anytime you can skid a big,
Crown Vic
boat, you know. Get a full skid on at the end. It's like, well, that's kind of cool.
Was it really?
So then McCandless travels to the Colorado River. And although he's told by the park rangers that he can't kayak without a license, he ignores their warnings and paddles downriver till he eventually arrives in Mexico. Now, I kind of get it, but why were the Swedes involved in this whole thing? Like, why that... little interlude.
I got nothing.
I mean, it was fine, but it was not necessary.
Because you needed some nudity?
I guess.
There was lots of nudity because there was that. And then there was him floating naked down the river, showing his junk, and then, which is towards the end of the movie. And then there was, you know, the whole nudist camp at the oh my God, hot springs.
Yes. But anyway, so he does, it's some really spectacular whitewater rafting shots. Very nice. It's actually all very well shot.
Seemingly supernatural abilities.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, the luck of fools.
Yeah.
Because even extras were telling him how he was stupid. telling him to wear a helmet. Anyway, he ends up in Mexico and his kayak is lost in a dust storm. And he has to cross back into the U.S. on foot. And he travels by freight train to Los Angeles. And this is where he charms his way into a Skid Row shelter. And then sees the reality of life on the Skid Row streets and decides to beat feet out of there. And he continues to travel by train in a very romantic way until he gets his ass handed to him in a bloody fashion by a railroad security person. And then he arrives December 1991 in Slab City.
Let me ask you this. When he was getting the crap kicked out of him, did you feel bad for him?
I mean, kind of, but, you know, there's only two ways that's going to go.
Yeah, he's going to die eventually.
No, I didn't feel especially bad for him.
After the train beatdown, I wrote down, oh, again, I could do without the shitty Eddie Vedder soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. The Ballad of the Busted Eye. So he arrives in Slab City in the Imperial Valley, California to winter it out till he can head up to Alaska. And he encounters Jan and Rainey again, and that's where he meets Tracy Tatro, played by Kristen Stewart.
Yes, I have something to confess here. Boyfriend Jesse identified Kristen Stewart as being from one of the Twilight movies.
Oh, yeah. She's all of the Twilight movies.
Not the one we reviewed.
Yes, not the Twilight movie we reviewed, absolutely. And Kristen Stewart's a fine actress. I mean, I don't have any problem with her. I mean, no, this role fine. Was fairly one-dimensional, but she does the quivering lip thing pretty well.
Well, and he gives her that quote, which I mean, oh. Actually, Jesse was like, you need to stop yelling at the television set.
This is a constant refrain from Jesse, I imagine.
I know. Yeah, I should get it embroidered in a quilt or something. Cross stitch.
Yeah, don't make him mad. He'll unplug your power chair. He'll never get out of there.
You know, because he gives that, in the movie he gives a quote, whether or not he actually gave a quote this great, I suspect not, but regardless, you know, if you want something bad enough, reach out and grab it, which is exactly what she was doing, asshole.
Oh, yeah.
And you left.
Well, she was 16 so. And he was 23 or something, and mm-hmm. He didn't have room on his bus for a girl. Although, you could see his plan may have been to eventually go back and tell tales.
Perhaps.
So, as much as I really liked Rainey in this movie, he was advocating statutory rape, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that assumes he knew what her age was.
Yeah, just the don't ask, don't tell Rainey philosophy.
Who knows? I don't know what the age of consent is in South Dakota. It might be 13, for all I know.
I think this was actually in California, and I don't know the answer to that, 1991.
Well, California.
Which one of us wants to enter that into our Google history?
Exactly, yeah. No, thank you.
Is my VPN on? I don't know.
So anyway, after the holidays, he decides to continue heading to Alaska, which saddens everybody in Slab City. And he camps near Sultan City, California. And this is where he encounters Ron Franz, played by Hal Holbrook from Creepshow and All the President's Men. A retiree who recounts the story of the loss of his family in a car accident while he was serving in the army.
I kept expecting him to make moves.
Exactly. I thought he was the creepy neighbor from Family Guy.
Yeah, me too. But, hey, nope. My boy, get your fat ass over here.
Can you do your Bobby Kennedy?
Mr. Hoover.
Anyway, so...
You can leave now, Mr. Hoover. You like that way too much.
I do.
Oh, Mr. Hoover, you must leave. Anyway, no.
Anyway, so this is where Franz takes McCandless under his wing to learn the craft of leatherwork.
Yeah, I expected him to show him his bondage gear in the garage.
Yeah, all you have to do is put this little red ball in your mouth and... I'll get the straps there.
The gimp. Pulp Fiction. Anyway.
Yeah. So after spending several months with Franz, who McCandless is trying to kill at every opportunity by making him run uphill in the desert. He's a 100-year-old man. He's saying he's mocking him.
Hey, assholes are gonna asshole.
So he spends a couple months with Franz, and then he decides to leave for Alaska. And Franz...
Gut-wrenching.
Yeah, it's just a very sad scene of Hal Holbrook.
Gut-wrenching. Yeah. It was horrible. It was so sad. I was like, ugh, I can't have feelings for this movie because I don't want to feel.
Well, except that if you were watching Alexander Supertramp, he never got his stupid grin off his face the entire time. Like he had this Christian Slater... As Harry Hardon, like, grin going.
Because he's a narcissist. He didn't care at all about Franz.
But he lets Franz down gently. And then we flash back to the abandoned bus. And we learn that living in the wild is kind of rough. First of all, when you ford across a little stream in the spring, You don't realize it's going to be a raging river in the summer, which, by the way, we just found two bodies of people that this happened to recently in Alaska.
When you say we, you mean like game?
Yeah, or, yeah. I don't mean we like anybody I'm associated with. I just
wish to be clear, like mom and dad didn't just go down to the creek and like, oh, there's two bodies.
Oh, yeah. You just stumbled upon them. Wink, wink.
No, sorry. There were two hikers that were lost in this very fashion.
I see.
By trying to cross a river that they could not cross successfully. By the way, spoiler also. Turns out if he had kept a
eight
map
tenths
with
of a
him,
mile. Yeah.
Yeah. If he had kept a map with him, he could have walked out.
Yeah.
That was an error in judgment to live completely without a map.
There was a hand tram 8/10 of a mile up the river that he could have gotten across on.
Yeah, I didn't know that, but he could have just walked out too, like 18 miles or something. Which if you
The article said if he had a topographical map, it would have shown him that 8/10 of a mile away was a hand tram to cross the river.
Yeah, well.
So.
Yeah, that's super tragic.
But that's not where his little hat was.
See, I waited for you to say that was super trampy.
Yeah.
Now all I hear is like bad Supertramp songs in my head.
There are no bad Supertramp songs.
There was no Breakfast in America for Mr. McCandless. He starved to death. Or okay, now the movie shows him steadily declining and getting super super skinny. I think Hirsch lost 40 pounds for this role.
It showed, man. It was brutal.
And it shows him growing steadily desperate. And then he makes the moose scene I thought was still kind of tragic. Like, after mustering up the courage to kill the moose and then can't figure it out and spoils it all, so he has dishonored the moose. Who has become his only friend and lover. And so he decides to try to live more, I guess he's running out of game.
He wears that moose's head as a crown as he does his little hippie dance. Sorry. It's a Bloodhound Gang reference.
So, he, in this version and in the original print of the book, he mistakes two similar looking plants and poisons himself. To where he's too sick to eat anything, and then he eventually starves to death.
Well, the plant that he, in the movie, the plant that he supposedly ate actually blocked digestion of nutrients, right?
Yes.
Yes.
So it didn't matter what he ate. He would not be able to digest any
They call it rabbit starvation, but there's a University of Fairbanks study. Guy said that was bunk. So there's some differing views as to what really happened.
The latest theory was that there was some sort of mold that grew on the plants and that kind of could have poisoned him.
Yeah, they're saying it was mold from the plants. The fact that he put the seeds that were damp-ish in a Ziploc bag just spawned the growth of these things since everything was damp. Because they said that he was approximately 66 pounds when they found him.
Ugh.
Or they approximate that he had been about 66 pounds when he died.
And he was found only 2 weeks later. I mean, hunters found him in the bus.
Yeah, in his zipped up sleeping bag.
Did you, Eric? Your instincts have been right all along. Ziploc is bad.
Did you hear about the girl that was missing for several days? After her car accident?
Is this a joke or is this a real thing? Oh, okay. I was waiting for the punchline.
How missing was she?
She was super missing. I'll promise to put links in the notes and then I'll go beep because I'll probably edit this out and won't put any links in the notes.
Way to set those goals.
She's some sort of small town, I think near Fairbanks. And she...
Like Fox or something?
No, she had been drinking, and she hit a car, like a parked car, I think. and then stumbled out. Like, I think somebody stopped to ask her, like, or maybe the car wasn't, maybe it was occupied. I can't remember. But she, like, basically fled the scene and just, like, for several days was just gone. And so they were concerned that she had either had something else happen to her. But it turns out they found her, like, 18 miles away. She stumbled into, like, a campsite of a camper, like, really, like, hypothermic and hungry. And so he took her in, got her to safety. And now she'll hopefully be arrested for drunk driving, although I think you can't. Toxicology is probably too far gone for that. And leaving the scene of an accident, 9 points on her license.
Like Laura Palmer style.
Kind of. But she's going to be fine, although they'll probably at least cite her for leaving the scene of an accident.
Ooh.
And now her Facebook history will show that she's a missing person or had been.
Is that a thing?
Is that a big deal?
Well, if you go for a job and you Google somebody's name, you're like, oh, yeah, you were missing in the woods because you were a drunk driver. I probably said this on the podcast before, but I will repeat it because that is something of a trademark of this thing. I remember a story of this girl who went camping by herself over the weekend, and she hadn't returned. So her boss reported her as a missing person, and I think her family, I don't know if she lived up here, the family lived up here too, but she lived on her own. But and she was known for, you know, go camping, whatever. And then all of a sudden, like, because she's a missing young, pretty white girl, they kind of like said, you know, well, she had some history of depression and all these things. So maybe she went down to kill herself. And cause you know, that happens. But like 2 days later, she showed up that she basically got lost in the woods and slept under a fallen tree, and was quite embarrassed that now all of her previous mental health problems were all detailed in the paper.
Surprise.
Yeah. So
how generous.
So, this guy dies in the woods and in the, not really in the woods, in the bus.
The magic bus.
Yeah.
In a super hacky death scene.
Yes. Yeah. You kind of expected him to like, kind of a Paul Rubens.
That's what he did.
The Vampire Slayer.
Yeah. That is what he did.
That is what he did.
He did the film school version of that.
Yeah. Well, so at the end, again, he appears to be sort of a tragic figure, but you know, somebody who is, I'm trying to think of like the theme is like his restless spirit and his optimism and his
no, his unprepared ass spirit.
Yeah. Well, there's that.
His arrogant spirit.
Yeah, I think it's, well, yeah, I guess it is arrogance and naivete.
Yeah, I mean, I understand, well, I shouldn't say understand. I can in some ways identify with having a little bit of the feeling like, oh, I can handle this. But not for one instant would I ever assume I could have survived in the middle of nowhere, even growing up in Alaska, I wouldn't be prepared to do that.
He read books though. During our 4th of July father's birthday celebration, I was talking to Drew a little bit about the fact that, you know, he was inspired to go on this thing by Jack London, a guy who wrote like White Fang and those books from the his home in Oakland, California. But yeah. But I have to correct it, even if it was just a personal conversation. It turns out Jack London actually did go on the gold rush to the Klondike in Dawson City and got scurvy. So he
scurvy?
Had, yes, he did, because malnourishment from being out in a camp. Yeah. You know. So even in a large group of people, the wilderness is pretty harrowing. So
he read books, but okay. So I'm gonna.
No. It's okay. Gloves are off now.
No. I was going to give a compliment. I suspect very few people I know would be capable of reading a book and surviving, with the exception, like, our father would have no problem. He could read a book and do it, but he could probably build a goddamn house by himself out in the middle of nowhere with his bare hands and some rocks and some spit. So,
well, yeah.
I mean, he has
I think
a certain.
He would be wise enough not to, though.
Well, but that's the thing. Like, he would have the skills to survive, but he would also have the skills to get the fuck out. So,
yeah.
Know when he's over his head. Know when perhaps the mud is a little bit too high. You know, just a speculation.
But, you know, that's it. When you're talking about life and death stuff, you know, it's a different deal. And here's the cynical point of view. So by glorifying this Yehu, he has inspired people to travel to the magic bus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stupid.
In fact, there's
a plaque now.
Oh, well, and the problem is, let's see, how cantankerous outdoors reporter, journalist Craig Medrid.
Oh, I remember that name.
Yeah. Yeah, he has opinions about McCandless. He does not look favorably upon the whole thing. He also thinks that the state should blow up the bus. Like, literally just remove it because it's just an attractive nuisance. And he's talked about, like, melting it into little ingots and selling them to stupid people who like Christopher McCandless. And
or taking it and putting it in a museum in Anchorage.
Well, or... Like,
here is the example of hubris and arrogance. And the lessons to be prepared if you're going to go out in the wilderness.
The other thing he suggested was to just post a couple signs on the trails in the area saying, this is the point where you will not be rescued anymore, unless you've left your $10,000 deposit, like if you were climbing Denali.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. That's reasonable.
There will
reasonable.
Be no one coming to look for you. Yeah. So that's actually always a controversy about rescues. People who put themselves in stupid positions and need to be rescued. That's I don't want to be the person judging somebody saying, oh, nobody's going to send help your way. I would prefer everybody's.
Way to take a stand there.
I'm not going to take Craig Medrid's stand. He's a cantankerous, there's a better word for it. He's a curmudgeonly guy.
Did I ever tell you guys about the cribbage tournament that we had in my office?
Yes.
You told us about Dad slinking through. Not slinking through, but...
Yeah. This is related. I was playing a game with our head of logistics, and he's a pilot, and he used to work for an aviation company that had the LifeMed contract.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And he was telling me how stressful that job was, because he was in charge of it, or he was in some sort of supervisory capacity. And so it was his call when there was bad weather to say, yeah, we're going to go out on that call, or no, we cannot risk our guys. So it was his call to determine whether somebody was going to get a life-saving medical flight or not.
Oh, no, that's too out of my pay. That's too high out of my pay grade for that. I can't. No way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nope. Sorry.
That would suck.
I mean, it's the thing where, you know, you don't want to have more people to rescue or more bodies to fish out.
That's right.
So as an Alaskan, I definitely have opinions about people like Christopher McCandless. Or actually I have more opinions about Alexander Supertramp. Because he is an asshole.
Big time.
Yeah. But people come to Alaska to disappear, like, on purpose, too. I mean, I don't mean going to the woods and die. I just mean people come to Alaska to, like, really, like, outrun their past or reinvent themselves all the time, too. And you can see that in lots of places, not just in the woods.
Pilgrim?
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, that's another woods example of it. But there's plenty of people who are here because this is where their past won't follow them. Although it's getting less and less like that now, I think.
Well, you have to go deeper and deeper into the interior, right?
Yeah. Well, you just have to get off the grid. I mean, this is a good place as any, really. But yeah, you have to be prepared to live, like, literally on your own. And turns out that's kind of a difficult thing. Especially if all you've read are books. And again, I mean... I thought this movie was a romantic tale But I don't like the fact that he's sort of deified. And it was an hour too long.
So you wanted him to make a movie based off the abridged version of the book you heard.
Or the newspaper article.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, again, I think some of the Swedes was cute and all. I think they were Swedes, right? But
some kind of Norwegian.
Danish.
Something. Yeah. But yeah, they, there's no reason to take 5-minute scene, 10-minute scene of all that to further the plot. Not a bit.
I don't know. Well, just shoot some lens flares and have some more voiceover.
Yeah, and the thing about actually all of his trip across the country is, you know, there's artistic license and things that were added to it, drama to it. I mean, there's...
Well, sure. Because no one really knows.
And it's certainly more exciting to throw him in whitewater rafting than if he just, put his boat in after Hoover Dam and called it good.
Hoover.
Wrong Hoover. And
it also lionizes his... sort of bohemian decisions to get rid of all his possessions. When even in the movie, that's not necessarily the case, right? He's driving along until he makes a dumbass decision to sleep in a floodplain.
Yeah.
And then his car gets destroyed in a flash flood. And all of a sudden, he's a romantic hitchhiker.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, he has to ride the rails once he gets back from Mexico, not because he got rid of the kayak, but because he lost it because he wasn't prepared and went to sleep in a place where it could get swept away in a sandstorm. So yeah. These were not conscious decisions he made to get rid of all his possessions. But again, maybe I just don't have enough of a charitable perspective of Alexander Supertramp.
My fear is someday our daughters are going to date Alexander Supertramp. So, Brother Jay, what's your verdict on the movie Into the Wild?
So, as a movie, I didn't hate it like as much as Brother Drew did for the super stupid stuff. I'd give it a B+. It was too long, and the Eddie Vedder really just drove me fucking bat shit crazy after a while, but you know, it was visually, it was beautiful to me. Reminded me of home, what I consider home.
Okay, just occurred to me, another reason I don't like Alexander Supertramp is because he would have heartfelt, with all his heart, sung along to "Hunger Strike" by Temple of the Dog.
Oh God. Yeah, probably.
Wait, I do that too.
Okay, well.
Do I like the movie? Sure, it was a fine movie. I'm not going to sit through it again anytime soon. If you haven't seen it, I think it's worth watching. But know that you're going into it, that there's a certain amount of baggage attached to this movie that is largely going to be it's just bullshit. As far as the real story, we don't know what the real story is because we don't know his perspective because he's dead. So it's a lot of drama that is all speculative. And looking back and having his family tell stories is one thing, but we don't know what the story is. So having having say it's based on a true story, okay, there is some basis in the true story in as much as this crazy guy went in the woods and died. But the rest of it's all conjecture, and your point, Brother E, is that, you know, he was crazy. Or romanticizing his escape, or any of the above. No one knows, because he's dead. Mostly by his own hands.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not even that harsh about the person. I mean, and this is a real person. I mean, he died.
Well, he was a real person.
He died doing what he loved. Sort of. Unless he loved eating.
Crickets.
Anyway. So Drew, was it worth it?
There are parts of this movie that are worth it. I think Emile Hirsch did a really good job. I think he should be commended.
Hopefully he got something to eat after.
I mean, he really did his best to show, you know, what a charismatic personality he must have had. And I think all the actors did a really good job. But this movie failed me because I think it was supposed to make me feel some sort of affection for the character of Chris McCandless. And I didn't. I had the same feeling watching him of that I had a couple years ago when I saw an old Doors concert, and I realized that I do not have the same perspective about Jim Morrison that I had when I was in high school. Yeah. You know, now I look at him and think, what a dumbass kid who thought he knew it all and we'll do the rest. Had a way with words. So people think he's profound when really he's full of shit.
The blue bus is calling us. The blue bus is calling us. Driver, where you taking us?
And that was the feeling I got from this character. He was educated and well-spoken, good-looking, so people naturally gravitated towards him and would give extra weight to just the bullshit that he would say. And I don't think that's what the movie was trying to make me feel. So in that sense, I think the movie is a failure. It was also too long. I did not enjoy the narrative style that they chose. The voiceover I thought was melodramatic. I expect better from William Hurt. He did a fine job, but I guess I expect more from him if he's in a movie.
You don't think that was a direction he was given?
I'm sure it was, but it's just he was wasted. It really could have been anybody in that role. They didn't capitalize on the Hurt.
Well, they probably only had 2 days of Hurt, right? 3 days, maybe? Maybe?
I assume he's buddies with Sean Penn.
Maybe.
But, yeah. So, no, I didn't enjoy this movie. Yeah, I don't have any sympathy for the dude. I hated the character. I hated the direction. The actors did a good job.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about it too. It's a fine movie. You're right. It's overly busy with the auteur stuff, or wannabe auteur stuff. I guess everybody's on tour, right? Yeah. So, but it's, I mean, it's a thing.
Not
indeed
halfway.
It is.
Yeah. So anyway, into the wild.
If you were Christopher McCandless, people would hear that and be like, oh, he's so right. It is a thing. Fuck you.
Oh, we are old men.
Yes.
So, speaking of that, housekeeping?
Housekeeping. I started listening to a new podcast, Damn You. So,
Damn Me.
Yes, you in the podcast. Now I'm just like, I'm turning into a podcast junkie. I blame you. I will not name this podcast on our podcast because I don't wish to besmirch it publicly. I will tell you privately what it is, but I'm listening to it and I'm already, it's so they have made the choice in
what genre of podcast is it? Like true crime or comedy?
If I tell you, it will give it away, and I don't wish to to besmirch them literally. Off the record, I will tell you, it is the podcast Zero Chaps of a Zero Book.
Oh, so it's like a history podcast.
Yeah, true stories.
Okay.
With historical events that are relevant and culturally recent in our near history, as it were. But they took facts and stories and they're narrating them and they're using people to make the narrations with, which is fine. But they're adding sound effects to the narrative that are clearly just taken from somewhere else and in some cases are discordant and don't even fit. For instance, there is a scene where some people are supposedly walking up a bunch of stairs and there's all these repeated, it's clearly a clip of footsteps in a loop that doesn't make any sense. And it's stuff like that. So it makes me appreciate our audio quality and value.
They're adding sound effects to try and create ambiance, but it is not having the desired effect for you.
No, it's actually, it's so bad because they also have really bad music in the background throughout the whole thing. So it's sound effects, bad sound effects, bad music, and this narration. So I get fixated on the bad sound effects and the bad music and lose the narration. And so I go back and listen to it and I mean, the stories are interesting. I don't fault the writing or the story. I just think that it would be 1,000% better without the music and the sound effects. So it makes me appreciate that we don't have that kind of shtick.
Oh, you're going to hate this episode when you listen back to it.
Full of Eddie Vedder.
Yeah, has Eddie Vedder been wailing the whole time?
Oh, well, that and Benny and the Jets keeps loop. Coming up every time we talk about William Hurt.
Yeah, but that's at least witty and clever. See, if it had been witty, it was. But it's like they took the most basic off the shelf clip from somewhere and spliced it in, and it doesn't work. It sounds silly. So
okay, well, are the stories interesting?
The stories are interesting. I've listened to 5 episodes now, so I'm trying it, but I don't know if I can keep with it though, because by today, the part 3 of one of the stories, which is the denouement, I don't know if I can finish it. They're just the sound effects are just pushing me over the edge. So anyway,
are there Wilhelm screams? That's what I would want. I'd be listening to those.
Not yet. No, not yet. That would have made me laugh at least, but that's probably inappropriate. So other than that, not much going around here. Just kind of status quo. Gonna head up to Seattle in a couple weeks to see Grandma Jo and hopefully go to the car museum in Tacoma.
Are the parents going down there too? Are you going by yourself?
This would be boyfriend Jesse and I.
Oh, okay, cool.
The parents are going to come down in September to look at car parts.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that goes.
Their house painters went camping instead of painting the house this weekend.
And we've had record hot temperatures.
Yeah, so what'll happen is the parents will come back from the cabin tomorrow, and they'll be visqueened into their house because they'll just started painting.
Like a crime scene.
Yeah, their house has been shut up all week. Not a window open.
They still have fish, right?
They used to. Until this week.
As I say, now they just have like soup. Ugh. So anyway, that's all I have. Pretty status quo. Tomorrow's going to be more physical fucking therapy. I'm looking forward to that, as you can tell. And then tomorrow I get to go have like a CAT scan on my lung, so that'll be fun too.
Oh, exciting.
Woohoo. And my dissolvable stitches are going away, so.
So.
Lucky you.
Hey, right in your face, Drew.
Well, not in my face, though.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, sorry. So, what happy-go-lucky housekeeping do you have, Drew?
Not much. We went on our longest camping trip ever the past weekend. 5 days.
Excellent.
Pretty rough. I mean, it was fun, but rough.
Except for the marshmallow face.
Yeah. Yeah. You heard about that, huh?
Yeah, mom was concerned.
Yeah, so I guess for everybody else, we were roasting marshmallows over the campfire, which we do quite often. And my oldest, who's 7, just about, she caught her marshmallow on fire, also not an uncommon occurrence, and she went to blow out the flames and got it too close to her face and ended up getting molten flaming marshmallows stuck on her sort of chin and cheek.
Yeah. Ugh.
So that was a near disaster. So she ended up with a little burn, a couple blisters. Yeah. It could have been way worse.
Yeah, not too bad, but.
No. Yeah, we were definitely very concerned about our safety practices.
You never thought your safety meeting before the fire should have involved sugar handling.
Yeah. No, it's just one of those things. You get comfortable and complacent.
Suddenly you're eating wild potato instead of...
That's right. So, but no, it was a fun trip. We were at a campground that was on the Kenai Lake, and we had purchased a little kid's kayak because they had them at Costco. So it was an impulse purchase, and we let them try it out. Again, probably not the safest thing to do, since neither my wife nor I are water sports people. So trying to instruct our children what to do in a kayak was pretty comical. You use the paddle to do stuff. I don't know. Just try it. but no, it was fine. They took to it like fish to water, so they had a great time.
Now you're building a kayak rack for your car.
We're gonna have to figure out something. But yeah, no, it's good. Had a good good birthday day for Dad. Hope he had a good time. He seemed like he did.
Yeah. Yeah, no disasters, which is always a good thing.
There weren't too many sad faces during the water balloons.
No, it's fine. Although we've taught the kids to throw water balloons only at people's feet, which is good and bad.
Well, especially because people have expensive phones.
That's part of it. Although I was trying out my new little camera that is waterproof, so I was trying to get as close to the action as I could, while not really wanting to get hit by a bunch of water balloons myself. But there's some funny pictures.
Yeah,
Gavin has a great shooting you face.
Yeah, it helps that he doesn't have any front teeth.
What was that?
Menacing.
Yeah.
Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.